have a message from the Baby Monster series that really shows clearly how baby monsters were responsible for taking down one of the most powerful, prolific, anointed, gifted, charismatic leaders the world has ever seen. His name is David, and this is his story. Comes to us courtesy of 2 Samuel 11. We're going to be in a passage of scripture that condenses an entire year down to just 30 verses or so. And as we go through this, you're going to feel like it, like maybe this is a lot of scripture. But it's really important because it allows us to get up in an airplane and look at this episode from his life from sort of 30,000 feet and gives us the perspective over this year period to watch the baby monsters grow into the full-blown monsters because he failed to take them out when they were small. So here's 2 Samuel chapter 11, starting in verse 1. It happened in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But notice, David remained at Jerusalem. Then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba?" Notice, "the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity. That means she had just finished her period before this day. And she returned to her house, and the woman conceived. So she sent and told David and said, "I am with child." In the morning it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter saying, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, wherever it's the most dangerous, and then retreat from him that he may be struck down and die." So it was, while Joab besieged the city, that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, "There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, a baby lamb, which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup." That's just adorable. A little sheep drinking from a cup. "And lay in his bosom." Stop it. This thing's cuddly too. "And it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him." So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man." A favorite children's book in recent history is a book called There's No Such Thing as a Dragon. And I don't know if you've read this book, but it's great. It's about a kid named Billy Bixby. The author's Jack Kent. And in the book, Billy wakes up one day and there's a little dragon sitting on his bed. Just a little tiny little thing. It's like the size of a kitten, just it's itty bitty dragon. He's surprised. So he comes downstairs. The dragon follows him. And he tells his mom, "There's a dragon in my room." And his mom, of course, tells Billy, before she sees the dragon, "There's no such thing as dragons." And Billy's like, "Well, that's strange, because there's one right there." And the mom now sees the dragon, but she can't go back on her word. She had said there's no dragons, so she pretends like she can't see the dragon. And as she does, the dragon begins to grow. Soon it's eating Billy's pancakes. Billy's frustrated because he's hungry. Breakfast being the most important meal of the day, you know. But she makes more pancakes. And she continues to try and persuade her son there's no such thing as dragons, while the dragon continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger and more of a problem and making more of a mess. And soon it's so big, it's filling up the hallway, filling up the living room. Its scaly wings are sticking out of the windows. This thing is enormous. It's grown to catastrophic proportions, and Billy is frustrated. He's trying to tell his mom there's a dragon. She doesn't believe there is one. So he's like, "Well, maybe there isn't one." Well, now eventually, the dragon picks up the entire house. It's wearing a house like a backpack. And eventually just kind of starts cruising down the street. He's just, you know, knocking stuff over because, you know, he saw an ice cream truck go by. So he's trying to get the ice cream. And, you know, it's based on a true story. Billy's dad shows up from work and he's surprised to find no home where his house normally is. His neighbors were good enough to point to the dragon going down the street wearing the house like a backpack. And so he starts chasing it down. He sees Billy and his mom up in the window. And he's like, "What's going on?" And then Billy's like, "It's the dragon." His mom's like, "No, there's no such thing as dragons, son." His dad said, "That's true. There is technically no such thing as dragons." And Billy gets so frustrated with his parents that he finally shouts out at the top of his lungs, "There is such a thing as a dragon. There's one right there, and it's huge." And at that exact moment, the dragon, now that it's noticed, and they're all acknowledging it's there, begins to shrink back down to its normal size. And of course, the moral of this story and the moral of the story that we just read is that when you deny something that's clearly there, is actually there, all it does is get bigger and create more problems. Here in David's life, we're reading a chapter of his story that, quite frankly, I would be fine with it not being in the Bible. I don't know about you. This is not how I want to remember David. But what we need to pay attention to is the fact that these sins that eventually reached Sam's Club-sized proportions started out small. They started out benign. They started out innocent enough. They started out as kitten-sized dragons, as baby monsters, if there ever was one. What do you mean? I mean, David's seeds that led to these enormous deeds actually began with him being lethargic. I see the beginning of this terrible chapter in David's life when he was just chilling, when he should have been getting after it. In the first verse that we read, it said, "This was the time of the year when kings go out to battle." And then it says, "But David stayed home." The kings go out to battle, but David sent Joab, his general, and said, "You take care of this one." If the kings are going out to battle, the scripture's not telling us that for no reason. It's the time of the year when kings go out to battle. David's the king. David doesn't go out to battle. What's the Bible trying to tell us? David is not where he's supposed to be. The point is, he never would have been home to see Bathsheba if he had been out on the battlefield like he should have been. He was sitting around exposing himself to more temptation than he needed to. He couldn't have been doing what he shouldn't have been doing if he simply would have been doing what he should have been doing. And you're like, "Thank you, Dr. Seuss." But I'm sure David had a good reason. You're thinking, David's the king after all. He probably had things to take care of. He probably needed to send Joab to be his proxy on the battlefield because he had urgent kingly business to take care of. David did have urgent things to take care of. In fact, if we read this from another translation, it actually shows us what was so busy that would keep David from the battlefield like he should have been as a king. Are you ready for this? Verse 2, it says, "One late afternoon, David got up from taking his nap and was strolling on the roof of the palace." Oh, yeah, he was very busy with a late afternoon nap. And so it was after his nap was over, he's like, "You know, what's on my calendar today? Oh, I think I'll stroll on the roof." Strolling. This is not a man with a full calendar. This is a man who you can almost hear the rustling of his robe in the breeze as he strolls about the palace. "Do I feel like taking a shower today? No, I don't really feel like taking a shower. It's too busy for a shower, right? I've got to stroll on the roof of my palace." He never would have been there to see Bathsheba if he had been out fighting like he should have been. Now, don't hear this as the anti-vacation sermon, because that's not what this is. Because it said clearly in the text, in the spring of the year when it was battle time. What does that mean? There has been a whole winter when it wasn't battle time. He had just finished a whole season that was by definition a time of recuperation, of recalibration, of where they couldn't fight because back in those days, the wheels of the chariots couldn't work in the winter because then it would be muddy. And so this was when, after the final rainy season was over, they could eventually resume the battles. That was when you could get back down doing what you're supposed to be doing. But David didn't do it. Here's why. Because David's now 50, and he had been a king for 20 years. And before that, there were 10 years when he acted like king because God called him as king. But he wasn't recognized as king yet. And oftentimes that's how it works. Our God seems to like to give people callings and then all but do everything short of keeping them from doing it to see if they trust him more or they love his plan. You see what I'm saying? A lot of times God tucks dreams in our hearts for what's going to be, but then puts us in times of adversity to see if we're out for our blessings, out for the blesser. If we trust him to see if we're really capable of handling the kind of blessing that he wants to give us. And so David's anointed as king, and then life gets more complex and more difficult. And that happens again and again and again throughout Scripture. God oftentimes allows those thorn in the flesh type seasons to keep us dependent on him. But we have to always have the perspective to keep going out to battle and keep embracing difficult things, because comfort zones don't keep your life safe. They keep your life small. And so David should have been going out to battle and sleeping on that cot in a tent with the other soldiers. But he thought, you guys go. I'm staying here in the palace. I got some napping to do. I got some strolling to do. Let me tell you, the moment you shift into a cruise control, you're doing something that's toxic for your soul. David's there where he shouldn't be, sauntering around the palace when he should be out on the battlefield. Because when you're not actively moving forward, you automatically slide backward. The Christian life is an uphill battle through the mud, and so we must always be stretching, always be going, always be doing something stupid in a good way. That's something that people will go, oh, that's crazy. J.D. Hudson Taylor once said, unless there's an element of risk in our exploits for God, there's no need for faith. And when you're living a life where you don't need faith, you're not going to be trusting God. And then you're ripe for temptation to attack. So David was lethargic. Then temptation shows up and he was lenient. He was lenient on the small sin that first popped up, this little temptation. So he's on the roof now. Shouldn't have been there, but okay, he's there. Now he sees this lady, she's bathing. If you go to Jerusalem, you'll notice that there's hills. And David's palace would have been on the top of the hill. And because the terrace hillsides, you would have been able to see onto the roof of where Bathsheba was taking her bath on the roof. And he sees her. And then the text says she was beautiful to behold. Now, there's a difference in the two Hebrew words that's used. One is to see, like I noticed that. The other is to stare and to gaze and to focus on that. Two different words. He saw her, but then found that she was beautiful to gaze at. Now, check this out. The first thing he did was see her. That wasn't a sin. And the devil always wants you to feel like being tempted is a sin, but it's not. Why does he want you to think that? Because he knows. Whenever the first domino falls, the second domino falls easier, and the third falls easier, and it gains momentum as it goes. Why? Because, well, the first time you break your diet, that's really hard. All of your willpower is there because you have that good record you don't want to break. But then once you've done it, it's easier to do it again. And then the fifth donut goes down so smoothly. But the first one I thought about for a long time. All right. So the devil wants you to think that to be tempted is wrong, but feeling like you could do something wrong is not wrong. It's only wrong when you take that bait. So you need to know that. So every temptation is an intersection, and you always have a choice. So David saw her, could have looked away. Dang, gonna have to put a hedge there. Gotta call the landscaper, get some big trees there, right? He didn't do that. He saw her. Now he's tempted. And what does he choose to do? He chooses to gaze, chooses to take a second look, chooses to now fantasize, chooses to dwell on this. So to see something, it pops up, it happens. You don't have to choose to stare at the beach. You don't have to choose to continue. Just throw your sunglasses on. No one's going to know. Look out of your peripheral vision. Oh, yeah. No, listen. To be tempted is not a sin. To give in to that temptation is. So David was lenient on that first temptation. Oh, what does it matter? Well, I would never do anything. I'm a married man. I'm a married man to 10 women. David had 10 wives, just so we're all clear on this. So we already see about that. And you're going, well, that's crazy. Well, in that day, that would have been nothing for a king to have 10 wives. But God specifically commanded the kings of Israel to not multiply to themselves wives or money, because he knew it would become a snare to their heart. So David was already violating that having wives multiple, okay? So now what does that tell you? Sin never satisfies. You think a guy with 10 wives, why would he even care about this woman? Because sin is always about what you can't have in the moment. So sin will never ever reach a point where it says, hey, that's enough. Why do you need to do that? You've had plenty. Sin will always want more and more and more. So you'll never be satisfied, because there's always going to be forbidden fruit. So if you think while you're single that if you sleep with that girl, you'll be happy. If once you marry her, she won't be the forbidden fruit anymore. There will be new forbidden fruit. And it's the person you're not married to. And if you get her, there will be new forbidden fruit. There's always, 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 always forbidden fruit. Because there will always be what you can't have in the moment. So David's lenient on the small sin of peeping and violating this girl's privacy. And so what happens? It just grows bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually he's having sex with her. He calls for her. And man, all along the way, do you not see God giving him opportunities to stop? He says to his servants, hey, do you know who lives down there in that brown house with the chimney? They're like, do you mean the one with the woman taking a bath on it? And he's like, oh, yeah, who's that? And they say, that's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, one of David's soldiers, Eliam. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. All right. Have a good day. Back to my nap. Oh, she's the wife of Uriah. Who's Uriah? One of David's most loyal, mighty men who had been risking his life for David since before he was king. Is that not the opportunity when she's somebody's daughter? When she's somebody's wife? When that man Uriah, her husband, is out there fighting in the battle that David should be fighting at this moment. But what does David say? You know, I would love to meet her, thank her for her service to her country. Do you want me to have her brought to your office? No, I actually have some stuff to hang in my bedroom. Have her brought to my bedroom. And of course, one thing leads to another. David's lenient on it when it's small. And so it just grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. Eugene Peterson, in his book Leap Over a Wall on the Life of David, puts it this way. How David was able to go from one to another to another to another, he says, David didn't feel like a sinner when he sent for Bathsheba. He felt like a lover. David didn't feel like a sinner when he sent for Uriah. He felt like a king. The subtlety of sin is that it doesn't feel like sin when you're doing it. And that's the truth. You should never expect while you're sinning to feel like it's sin. It's always feeling like you're doing something right in the moment. That's the nature of sin. It's deceitful. It lies to you. It always focuses on you, the pleasure, and downplays any possible punishment. So now, David's done what he's done. He sends her packing. No eggs, no coffee, no toast. She's just out there. But the word soon comes back, I'm pregnant. Well, how do you know it's mine? I had just had my period before I came there. My husband's off of battle right now. It's yours. So what does David do? Does he come clean? Does he call the prophet? Does he tell God, turn it to him in prayer, own the consequence, the embarrassment, look his kids in the eyes and his wives in the eyes and tell them that he's committed adultery and done this? No. He shifts into the third phase of this story, and that's the phase that we're calling damage control. Damage control. All right? How do we control the narrative? How do we hide this? How do we cover this up? There's got to be a way. I'm a king. I'm a chess player. How do I cover this up? I know if Uriah comes home and has sex with his wife, he'll think it's his baby. So he sends for Uriah to come home. He didn't read it, but Uriah comes home. David thinks he'll go home and sleep with his wife, think the baby's his. But Uriah is an honorable man. And so when he calls for him, he says, "What do you want? What can I do for you?" "Oh, I just wanted you to have a couple of days off. Go on home. Enjoy. You've been a good soldier." But Uriah is wearing his armor and refuses to take it off. He says, "I've got my brothers out there dying on the battlefield. How can I live like it's not war conditions?" He sleeps on David's front porch. Will not go home and do this. And so David thinks, "All right, this guy's tougher than I thought. I'll get him drunk." So he slips something into Uriah's drink, gets him drugged, thinking once he's out of it, he'll for sure go home. But listen to this. Uriah is more honorable drunk than David is sober. And even though he's all confused and disoriented, he once again sleeps on the front porch. And so David says, this guy has sealed his fate. So he writes a note to Joab saying, "I want you to put him in the hottest part of the battle and make sure that Uriah doesn't come home." Seals it with his signet ring, hands it to Uriah, and Uriah is so trustworthy, he doesn't open the letter and carries it to Joab, even though it has his own death sentence on the inside. As you read this story, Uriah comes out sparkling and is just an incredible man of integrity and character and honor. And so now Uriah is killed. Why? Because David is creating so much damage as he's trying to do damage control. And it always is that way. And now Uriah's dead, David marries Bathsheba, and the baby's born premature. And David thinks he got away with it completely. But what was this year like for David? This year before this confrontation with Nathan, what was this year like for him? It was absolute misery. In fact, he later on opened up about what the year of hiding was like in Psalm 32:4, when he said, "My strength was sapped. My inner life dried up like a spiritual drought within his soul." Psalm 51:3 says, "The deed he had done, he said, it haunts me day and night." So it always is, because sin, which lies to us, always when it pays in death. Proverbs 20:17 says, "Food gained by cheating tastes sweet to a man, but in the end, he will end up with a mouthful of sand." And tragically, in David's story, as in so many situations, it's his kids that suffer the most. He will be forgiven because God is a God of forgiveness and grace. And at the end of the day, our standing before him is not about our deeds. It's about the deeds of Jesus Christ. But the consequences that must be lived out of and dealt with oftentimes shows up worse in successive generations. And so it is in David's life. But that's not the end, the damage control era, because then David enters into the most poisonous, the most dangerous period of his life, and that's where he becomes pious. Pious, and what does pious mean? Pious means inflated self-righteousness. It means smug. It means holier than thou. It's where you're really on the inside full of deceit, but the veneer you put up to project to the world, it's everything's fine. I'm perfect. David was still doing this year, showing up at the temple, doing all the sacrifices, all the things everybody would accept. So he was going through the motions of religion, but he had a wall barricaded between him and God. There was no sweetness. There was no intimacy. There was no friendship. All of that inner life had dried up through his choosing. He wasn't drawing near to God. And as a result, during this time, what happened? What happens to all of us? We become Pharisees. When there's no inward life, but you're still going through the motions, it's so easy to have this great sense of piousness. What does that mean? I'm saying this, that often those who are the most openly judgmental are actually secretly hypocritical. There's a connection between openly judgmental, denouncing sin. I've read some Facebook pages. It's just like, every day, what sin are you there to denounce? How wicked and vile is the world? But a lot of times there's a link between being openly judgmental and being secretly hypocritical. Jesus put it this way. He said, usually it's the person who has a plank sticking out of their eye, right? They're working in the shop and a little splinter came off the wood. Now they have a 2x4. Jesus is the best. You read this stuff and it's funny. Imagine a 2x4 sticking out of someone's eye who then, as he walks around, says, "Hey, you got something in your eye." And you're like, "What do I have in my eye?" "A little bit of sleep. You got a little sleep in there. Let me help you." And they like turn to help you and they're knocking stuff off the shelves. Do you want that guy to help you get the sleep out of your eye? That guy who's got a 2x4 sticking out of his eye? But he's going, hey, wicked sinner, repent. Get over here. Let me help you out, right? It's like, no, thank you. That's David here. And it reaches a boiling point when he hears the story about a guy who killed a baby lamb chop, the pet. Even though he had all these herds and thousands of sheep, but he chose to take someone's precious little pet that slept in his own bed. And Nathan knew what he was doing because David was a shepherd, and he risked his life to save sheep from wolves and from bears and from lions. So when he hears about this rich guy that had no pity, one translation puts it this way: does this man think there's no justice in my kingdom? Does he think I won't deal with this? I am Batman. I will. When you're living out of this judgmental spirit with death on the inside, you don't see clearly. So what did David say? I'm going to kill this guy, and then he's going to pay. Well, David, if he's dead, you know, he can't pay, you know, because dead men can't pay, but he's not thinking clearly. He's just like, this guy's going to pay because it's the telltale heart of his own sin that he's actually speaking to. What David did was allow him to see himself in the mirror. And that's when Nathan lovingly said, David, it was you that I was talking about. It was you that did these things. And David fell on his knees and repented because he realized that Nathan, his friend, was right. So here's my question. How can we avoid this from happening? Because it's great to pile on David, right? But the real question is, if it had happened to him, it can happen to us. So how do we avoid that from happening? Because I guarantee you, if you were able to sit down with David while he was penning Psalm 23, because don't forget, you read that epic psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." David had to write that. So he's out alone in the fields, and there's probably like 9 versions of how it starts. You know, originally it was going to be, God takes care of me like a baby sheep. No, that's no, and he crumples that one up. The Lord is my shepherd, I'm good. No, I shall not want. Oh, I got it. And if you would have said, hey, David, you showed up in a DeLorean or something. Hey, David, hey, question. Do you think it's possible that one day you're going to have an affair and then murder one of your best friends to cover it up? Do you think it's possible that you're going to ignore God for a whole year? You won't return his calls, but you'll still be showing up at church for a whole year? David would have said, there's no way. I'd never do that. God's my shepherd. I have everything I need. And so here's my point. You and I, how many Psalm 23s have we written? Yeah, exactly. So if it can happen to David, we're not immune to this temptation. And any of us could do exactly what he's done, or worse. So how do we avoid such a thing? 3 things that could keep us from such a thing. And the first one is that we have to be receptive to conviction. Open to conviction. We have to be receptive to the conviction of God's Holy Spirit. Because no doubt, at every single moment, God was giving him the chance to do right. No one has overtaken any trespasses except that which is coming to man. And God always provides a way of escape. What does that way of escape look like? It's that little rumble strip, right? It's that little rumble strip that, you know, that we hid, and it's saying, no. Let's be receptive. Speak, Lord, your servant is listening to conviction. The second ingredient is that we have to keep short accounts with God. Keep short accounts with God, meaning don't let things pile up. Have you ever waited too long to balance your checkbook? Have you ever waited too long to go through the receipts. And so then you're like, I don't remember what that was for, what this one was for. I don't remember what this one's for. And so it's intimidating because you allowed it to pile up. And so there's so much. If you keep short accounts, meaning every day you go through and balance, every day you approach it, you deal with it when it's fresh, it's much easier to do. Let's keep short accounts with God. What does that mean? We are all going to sin. Newsflash. Every one of us. So when you do rush to God, rush to Him. Rush to His presence. Ask forgiveness. Don't let it pile up. Keep short accounts with God. And then thirdly, have the right friends. I see it in David's life. Thank God he had Nathan, not just Joab. David had Joab in his life who didn't. Joab knew exactly what David was doing, and he helped him cover it up. And by the way, he never let him forget it. From this moment on, Joab will be uncontrollable by David because he has this over him, by the way. So here's my question. Do you have a circle full of Joabs, or do you have some Nathans? Do you have people in your life who are going to help you on the path to sin? Or do you have people in your life who are willing to lovingly confront you when you're making decisions that will harm you? I see two sides of the Nathan. I see, hopefully, A, that we need to fill our lives up with Nathans. There's people who lovingly can address these little issues. Hey, it seems like the way you talk about your wife when she's not there, that's not the kindest. It seems like you interrupt a lot. You see what I'm saying? Do you have a life full of Nathans, or do you have Joabs who are bad examples and not doing anything about the things that they're seeing in your life? But the second ingredient is that we need to learn to be Nathans too. That we need to be Nathans too. And what I mean by that is that we know how to properly speak to people about the errors in their lives and the errors that we see in the world with grace and with truth, with love and honesty, but with a broken heart. Nathan didn't rush in and say, you know, you scummy sinner. Yeah, I do follow some Christians on Facebook. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, he was winsome. He knew how to speak to David. He knew how to not get David's shields up. And the way that we speak about it should be with the wisdom and the dexterity and the love and the grace of a Nathan. So those three things, I think, will keep us back from David's mistake here as he messed with the baby monster that eventually grew big enough to chew him up. What about Billy Bixby? You're probably wondering, how did Billy's story turn out? So the baby monster that grew big, eventually when it was recognized, it got small again. Now it's the size of a kitten. And the family's decompressing. And Billy's mom says, gosh, so I guess dragons are real. But why did it have to get so big? Billy said, I don't know. I guess it just wanted to be noticed. And if we will notice the baby monsters in our lives, they won't be able to grow. Why? Because sin grows best when it's left unaddressed. And when we'll address it, we won't be lethargic. We will be hungry. We won't be lenient. We will be disciplined. We won't be thinking damage control. Damage control. We'll be thinking forgiveness. And there won't be a bit of piousness, of smugness about us. We will be humble.